This looks complicated.
Good afternoon, colleagues, members of the public. I want to welcome you to this March 25th meeting of the Senate Committee on Workforce. We are going to be doing two things today. First of all, we're going to have an informational session on workers' comp because we do have workers' comp bills that have been referred to our committee. And so we're going to have a brief workers' comp 101 to start this off. And then we are going to return to our work session on Senate Bill 454. We have a number of amendments to hear about, and hopefully one of those will make its way down to Ways and Means by the end of this this day. So with that, I'm going to open our informational hearing on workers' comp 101, and I'm going to ask John Schiltz to come up and Randy Elmer and John Mullis. Could you, three of you, come up? Thanks, John. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm John Schiltz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division. I really appreciate the invitation to present today. I know that you want to keep this brief, so in that spirit, I'm going to go through this pretty fast. But please stop me and ask anything you need. I'll make sure that this is going to work. Well, no, I'll try this one. Okay, so what is workers' compensation? Really, it's a social insurance program that came out of the 19th century Industrial Revolution when there were large numbers of accidental injuries, deaths on the job. It protects both employees and employers from financial loss and hardship due to those injuries. The Great Compromise is sometimes talked about. It's the where employees are guaranteed their medical benefits and wage replacement benefits, and employers, in exchange, are protected from lawsuits. Oregon's history is that before 1913, there wasn't a workers' compensation system here. Most states enacted their workers' compensation legislation around this time. And the only recourse for workers injured on the job in those days was to sue their employer for workplace injuries. And that was expensive and typically unsuccessful for workers. By 1914, the Oregon legislature enacted our first workers' compensation law. And employers in high-risk industries were the first ones subject to that law. And they purchased their insurance through a state fund at that time. The legislature has stated findings for the Oregon workers' compensation system, and I think they're important to touch on. First is that economic enterprise and work are valuable Oregon resources, that injuries will and do occur at work. Lawsuits are particularly costly and have low benefit for both parties. An exclusive statutory system of compensation provides the best solution at this time, and that the costs of the system are eventually paid by the consumers of Oregon's goods and services. Our system is like many other systems around this country and around the world. Most of our workers are covered in the statute. You can look at ORS 656027 for a list of exceptions in terms of who really isn't covered under Oregon workers' compensation. But most of our workforce is covered. It's a no-fault insurance system, and that means that workers to prove their claims or employers don't have to prove fault or negligence. They're really just irrelevant in workers' compensation. Exclusive remedy is a term that you'll often hear. What that means is that employers are protected from lawsuits, and the workers' compensation system is the exclusive remedy for workers who are seeking harms to be redressed. It provides comprehensive medical treatment, medical care that's necessary to treat the injuries provided. 100% of the cost is covered. Payment for wage loss and disability are provided to workers. Workplace safety is a key component of our system. And in fact, Oregon has a uniquely large safety culture. And a couple other unique Oregon features I'd mention is just our return to work programs. They really do work. They touch a lot of workers who have disabling claims. And we also have efficient administrative dispute resolution processes, both at the division and then a board mediation program at the Workers' Compensation Board that's become a national model. Oregon history, again, in 1966, the system changed through legislative activity to the system we recognize today for the most part. Again, most employers are subject to the law that they must provide coverage. They have three choices to obtain that coverage. First, through the state fund or safe corporation, as we know it today. They can buy insurance from a number of private insurers that offer workers' compensation insurance in Oregon, or if they qualify to be a self-insurer, they can become self-insured. Between 1987 and 2001, there were a number of efforts to reform Oregon's history, and I'll touch back on this, so I won't go over this in any detail, but those reforms have emphasized return to work, improvement in safety. Enforcement at the division was improved. Managed care came into being here in Oregon. There's been improved medical care. There was a much more precise definition of what was meant by a compensable injury, and litigation processes and dispute resolution were streamlined. So the Oregon system today, we have a very affordable system for our employers. We have the ninth lowest premiums in the nation. Today, we are at 26% below the national median in average cost. Back in 1990, during the heart of the reform era, we were 49% above the national median in terms of employer costs. The benefits for workers are strong as compared to other states. I'll just give one example. I'll touch on this again towards the end of the presentation. 80% of other states pay lower wage replacement benefits than Oregon does. Employers pay their premiums to workers' compensation insurance companies who provide the coverage. Premiums finance most of the benefits received by workers, but I did want to mention that employers and workers jointly fund a fund known as the Workers' Benefit Fund, and that provides funding for some other programs in our system. The legislature plays a key role in the Oregon workers' compensation system. You make the laws that determine who must be covered, who must provide that coverage. You set levels of benefits. You decide who qualifies for those benefits, and you give policy direction for the entire system. Where I work at the Department of Consumer and Business Services, we regulate the workers' compensation system. At the Workers' Compensation Division, where I work, we make certain that employers are providing insurance for their workforce, and we ensure that the workers are getting their benefits on time and they're getting what's due them. The Insurance Division monitors the financial health and performance of the insurance companies, primarily through looking at their financials, rates and forms administration. Oregon OSHA enforces workplace safety requirements. And the Workers' Compensation Board serves an important role in resolving disputes through both hearings and an appellate system. The Management Labor Advisory Committee, and John Mullis is here. He can talk about this more than I, so I won't steal all his thunder. But that's a very important part of our system here in Oregon. It includes five representatives from business, five representatives from labor. They make up, business and labor make up the two customers of this system. Employers and employees are who the system is designed to serve. Members are appointed by the governor. They're confirmed by the Senate. They're charged by the law to study issues that affect workers' comp. The committee reports findings and provides recommendations on their findings to the legislature and the governor. This is a forum for employers and workers to discuss complex workers' compensation issues. It's not unusual for those discussions to last many months, sometimes more than a year. Opportunity to reach consensus on recommendations is provided, especially in regard to recommendations for statutory changes that would improve our current system. In the past, the legislature also has asked MLAC to review specific topics that the legislature wants MLAC to take on. We have ombudsmen for both injured workers and small businesses here in Oregon. They're both housed at the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and they report to the director, not into the division, to keep an arm's length distance. The Ombudsman for Injured Workers advocates for workers' benefits and rights. They're a resource for both workers and their attorneys, as well as a lot of other folks in the system, including myself. I go down and talk to the Ombudsman on a regular basis. Small Business Ombudsman helps the employer by navigating the system, helping them finding coverage, and clarify whether their classification, what determines their premiums, are correct. Insurers and self-insured employers process the claims. They pay the benefits directly to workers. They rate permanent disability if the worker has permanent impairment. They set aside reserves to pay future liabilities. They assist with safety program administration, and they implement a lot of our return to work programs. Oregon's system is like any other system, and it's appropriate to ask, is the Oregon workers' compensation system effective? To answer that, we need to look at the experience of who workers' compensation systems were designed to serve. So we need to think about, are they effective for employers and workers? There's been recent articles, national articles about workers' compensation that I'm sure some of you have seen, published by ProPublica and National Public Radio, that make the case that over the last 10 to 15 years, workers' compensation reforms in most states have saved money for employers by cutting benefits to workers. And I'm here today partly to say Oregon's story is actually very different than that. Oregon's noted nationally and by independent sources as having achieved both lower costs to employers as well as reasonable benefits to workers. As I mentioned before, our reform era was between 1987 and 2001. What precipitated the need in Oregon for the reforms was a crisis. We had very high costs for employers. We had poor benefits for workers. The money that was in the system was often being siphoned off by others who weren't workers or employers. The system was described one time to me as a mile wide and an inch deep, and I won't forget that. I think that was an apt description. Workers and employers were in agreement at that time that the system needed to change and change dramatically. And I'm not here to go through all the changes that were made. There were a lot. Primarily, the changes were designed to lower costs for employers and raise benefits for workers. So I mentioned before, we now are sitting at the ninth least expensive costs in the nation for workers' compensation. Workers' benefits have improved here, and that's the other side of the story that sometimes doesn't get out. Average temporary disability or wage replacement benefit if a worker is disabled from his job is up an average of 76% over the last 20 years. Permanent disability benefits used to be changed every odd year session, and we would come here and ask for increases to permanent disability. Now they're tied to annual changes in the state average weekly wage, and those benefits are up over 70% as well over that same time period. Recently, in the 2009 session, fatal burial benefits were doubled. In 2013, the last year we have data for on this issue, over 25% of our workers who had disabling claims received some form of return to work service to help them get back to work. Safety is an incredibly good story here in Oregon. In 1987, 3.7 out of every 100 Oregon workers suffered a disabling injury on the job. Today, that rate has fallen to 1.1 worker out of every 100 workers. And while we want to prevent that injury to that one worker as well in every 100, that's quite an improvement. The injury rate has fallen in Oregon in every industrial category except one, which is healthcare, and there's reasons for that. And that also includes logging in Oregon. So it's not a case of Oregon's economy changing as much as it's a case we've just got much safer workplaces. Our improved workplace safety has resulted in fewer injuries and fewer catastrophic injuries. We have less permanently disabled workers. We have less permanently and totally disabled workers. We have less fatalities on the job today. We have better return to work programs. We have better medical practices, especially in the area of diagnostics and physical rehabilitation. It's also resulted in an affordable system, as I've touched on, and I think good benefits, and most importantly, better outcomes for workers. Workers' compensation in Oregon is nationally recognized. There are published articles about the Oregon workers' compensation system, and I don't want to talk too much about that, but I do like to mention it. However, workers' compensation in Oregon, it's always a work in progress. There's always the need to work on things and to improve. This session offers quite a few bills on workers' compensation issues and policies. Some of those topics on the Senate side so far include independent medical examinations, compensability determinations in light of some court cases, self-insurance financing, particularly for employers, as well as attorney fees, which actually that's a House bill, but I wanted to mention it because I think it's an important bill. So that one's still pending in the House. And I can stop here and take any questions directly to me or wait until the rest of the panel has had a chance to address you.
Yeah, unless there are any pressing questions, why don't we hear from the others? So, Mr. Elmer?
Thank you, Chairman Dembrough, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Randy Elmer. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. I've been practicing for about 32 years. I'm also here as a representative of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I presented some written testimony, and it was traditional and supportive type testimony, but I do understand my role here today in this informational session is to help you understand this bill that we've proposed, House Bill 2764.
Yeah, actually, it's you know, even broader than that. Okay. Although we appreciate that, but just you know, to give us a sense of you know, the role of attorneys in workers' comp cases.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What we believe is that at the present time, Oregon workers are facing a crisis, and the crisis is their failure to have access to justice in the workers' compensation system. In fact, what we are seeing increasingly is lawyers who used to represent injured workers will no longer do that. So we proposed a bill which, in its own modest way, proposes some changes to try to fix that problem. And that is what is House Bill 2764. But in the broader sense of things, what has happened since 1989 and 90 reforms is, number one, the system has become extremely complex. As you can see by the diagrams before me, they illustrate, in part, the dispute resolution process in the workers' compensation system, and this is not complete, but it gives you a picture of how complex it is. And workers simply cannot negotiate themselves through this, the complexities of this system by themselves. At the same time that it's become more complex and they're feeling more alienated about seeking benefits on their own, the economic model that was set up by the reforms of 89 and 90 have put us on a track for essentially creating disincentives for attorneys to represent injured workers. There are a lot of areas of our workers' comp practice in representing injured workers where we are mandated by law to represent our workers, and there is absolutely not even a provision to get paid for it. In other cases, there are fees that are set by the board and the workers' comp division, frankly, that I'll talk about in a minute, that have been stagnant for so long that they don't really represent the dollar value that was in place when they were set. But the third thing that has happened is there's become this huge imbalance between the amount of fees and resources that are utilized by the insurers, employers, and self-insured employers as opposed to those that are available to injured workers. I commend to you this report by the Workers' Comp Division, the 2014 report that you may have seen, and it talks about all the statistics of the workers' compensation system, but on page 9 of the report, it points out that in the last year that they recorded the amount of fees that were paid, $34.2 million were paid to all attorneys on both sides of the fence. That's about 7% of the overall work comp budget, or premiums, I should say. Of that amount, 20.7% were paid to claimants' lawyers. That is a gap of about $13.5 million between one side that represents the workers and the same cases that are being represented by defense. That gap has got to narrow if we're going to incentivize any lawyers to step into the arena and represent these workers. I think it's appropriate to say that in 1989, I was amongst approximately 400 lawyers who probably called their specialty workers' compensation law for claimants. I think it's also a fair statement to say that today that number is approximately 80. And I would even dare go so far as to say of those 80, probably only 30 are really specialists in their field. I do this 70% of my time, but frankly, I must subsidize my practice with Social Security disability law and personal injury law and employment law. I could not keep my office doors open and pay my staff if I was having to do that on the fees that I'm paid solely from work comp. Let me just focus for a second on those fees. The fees are highly regulated as to claimants' lawyers. We cannot get paid a fee unless it's approved by the Workers' Compensation Board or the Workers' Compensation Division. On the other hand, fees that are paid to the defense bar must only be reasonable, and it's contractual. So whatever their insurer, self-insured employer clients feel they're willing to pay for their representation, they're free to pay it. Of the two kinds of fees that we are paid what's called assessed fees. They're assessed directly against the insurers, and we only get those in two instances. One, where we're instrumental in overcoming a denial of compensation, or two, where we obtain penalties for unreasonable conduct on the behalf of the insurer, unreasonable resistance to the payment of compensation. If we fail in our efforts to achieve those goals in any hearing, we go unpaid. All other fees are out of compensation fees, which means they are taken out of the workers' increased benefits or out of the workers' settlement. This proposal that is in House Bill 2764, it only touches on 35% of those 20 point some million dollars that are paid to claimants, because 65% of those are out of compensation fees that this proposed law will not address. So it's a very modest proposal that will be before you hopefully at some point in time. What I think needs to happen is a recognition that workers cannot negotiate the system by themselves. They do need legal representation. We need to change the laws to balance this up a little bit, to create incentives for the insurers to process claims appropriately so that we're not even disputing over whether fees get paid to either side. This bill would do that. And the other thing is to give lawyers in our community an incentive to get involved in this practice and represent workers. And so that's the highlights of why we propose the bill and why it's necessary. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to take those questions now.
Thank you, Mr. Ellman. We'll come back to
them. Thank you for your opportunity.
Let's hear from Mr. Molis first. And I think you're primarily going to talk to us about MLAC. Is that right?
That's correct, Chair Dembro. Members of the committee, the hat I'm wearing today is one of 10 volunteers that serve on the Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee. And as John spoke to you earlier, this committee came out of the Mahonia Hall settlement, and it was an effort to try and... My name for the record. John Molis. One MLAC volunteer today. Sorry. Our charge has always been to try and... build off the reforms that came out of that compromise and make sure that there's balance in the system going forward. And I would like to give a credit and a shout out to I'm currently the labor co-chair, and my current management co-chair, Guy Boilo, and prior to that, Kathy Nishimoto. I both enjoyed working with them. They're both very fair and honest people and deserve some credit for the half of the side that they're volunteering to work for as well. We try and find a good balance between employer rates and employee benefits, and we spend most of our time in our meetings on basically one of two things. The first being someone can come forward with a concept that thinks that would benefit the system, whether it's a group of workers or a group of employers or a provider such as, you know, nurses or chiropractors, and with a proposal that would say, why don't we do this or that, and it would be better for the system. And so we'll take a look at that and come back and make recommendations possibly. And then the second one is to try and weigh in on proposed legislation. And we're currently meeting every other week. We have been for the last month and a half or so, and we'll continue to do so probably for most of the rest of the session. We've already acted on a number of proposed pieces of legislation, either recommending support or not support to the legislature. There's still a few that we're working on, and we're going to do our best to come up with recommendations on those as well. So that's just a brief overview of the role of MLAC and from one person's perspective, and I would do my best to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you all. Actually, I have a question for you, John, just following up on that. So, you know, as Mr. Schultz mentioned, there are a number of bills that are, you know, before us this session. And so presumably all of them will be looked at by MLAC. And then, so I assume that many of these bills are going to be amended or are in the process of being amended. So in your more or less weekly meetings, you will look at the most current amendments. Should we be trying, as we're scheduling our hearings, trying to make sure that MLAC has had a chance to review them before, you know, just to be able to take advantage of that before we move on them?
Chair Dambrough, yes, that's correct. We do our best to keep abreast of amendments and not act until we've received the amendments back and had a chance to review them and heard input from both sides of the issue, if there is two sides. But that's absolutely right. We just passed out a couple of items last Friday that we had been waiting on amendments. And once the amendments came in and they did what they said they were going to do and both sides were happy, then we were able to make recommendations on those pieces of legislation. So, yes, that's correct.
And in those cases where we don't get a recommendation from MLAC, you know, either for or against, does that mean that MLAC is split on that, that you weren't able to? I mean, do you always try to either give a thumbs up or a thumbs down?
Chair Dambrough, yes, I think that's the goal, is to always try and have MLAC weigh in one way or another. I think in the last long session, we were able to do that on I think everything that was proposed to us, is to weigh in one way or another. We've done that on a number of issues already this year, and there's still a couple of issues that are outstanding.
Okay, thanks. Anything either of you would like to add to that subject, the MLAC process? No. Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
Thank you for that overview. I appreciate it. Are we, maybe this is just for you, Mr. Chair, are we going to be hearing from, we have labor here, are we going to be hearing from the management side at all, or?
So we, you know, we're certainly open to hearing from management, but just for the purposes of this panel, you know, this info session.
Okay. Yeah. I just wondered if later for this invited testimony, was there invited testimony? No?
No, okay. But it's just, you know, this is who the people that arranged this informational hearing gave us.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
But I'm certainly open if there's anyone in the room that.
I was wondering if somebody was going to take us through these little charts here. They look kind of complicated.
Yeah. I'd kind of prefer to avoid them if
possible. I would think so.
Senator Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of questions. So, John, I understand there are some vacant positions right now, and is that affecting your deliberations?
Chair Dambrough, Senator Rosenbaum, I don't know that it's affecting our decisions. We do have a quorum on both sides. But obviously we would prefer to have a full board to be dealing with these, because if you have, you know, 10 people and 10 minds in the room rather than 7 or 8, I think you have a better chance of getting, you know, more opinions and more viewpoints and hopefully arriving at the right decision. So I don't think it's hurting us, but I would say it would be more helpful to have a full board.
And how many positions are vacant?
I think there's 3 that are vacant now, one labor and 2 management. And I think the 2 management are going to be ready tomorrow, right, for confirmation. And the labor person I don't think has been ID'd yet or nominated. or persons, people.
An additional question.
Yes, please.
Yes, for Mr. Elmer, so those are really shocking statistics that you gave us about the number of claimants' lawyers, or I don't know if that was just claimants' lawyers that you were citing that used to be over 400 and now are 80. But what happens, so are there workers who are currently unrepresented because of a shortage of lawyers, or are just 80 lawyers representing every injured worker in the state, or what is, how is that affecting people?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, thank you for that question. Yeah, the numbers I was putting before you are only those of the claimants bar. There's significantly more attorneys practicing for insurers and self-insured employers. A lot of workers are trying to represent themselves in this system or relying on the resources of the Ombudsman's Office of the Workers' Compensation Division. But we must understand that no lawyers are on the staff of the Ombudsman's Office. They cannot give legal advice. So at best, they can kind of navigate a worker through the system. For example, if a worker gets a closure of his claim, they can say, here's the form you need to file to get to the next step. But no one's there to present the evidence and help them gather the evidence and seek out the best result as far as benefits are concerned for them, unless they can find someone in this group I've talked about who's willing to take the case. And of course, in some instances, we have to make a financial decision. If we're going to be spending, say, 5 to 10 hours on a case that will have a result of a $500 fee, it's economically unfeasible to take that case for that worker. I realize that that's a huge benefit to a worker. Even a $500 change in their time loss could be huge. But take time loss for an example. Whether I spend an hour helping get a worker a raise in his time loss rate or 12 hours, my fee is 25% of the additional compensation with a maximum fee of $1,500. That cap was established in 1997 and has not been raised since. And that money has to come out of that worker's pocket on top of that. So one of the things we think that probably needs to be changed to fix this is make sure that if that mistake is corrected, a reasonable fee is paid for the time invested and is paid from the insurer, for example. But yes, to get back to your question, there is a crisis amongst workers. And when you hear from the labor union leaders, they will tell you when their members approach them and say, I have a denial, I have a legal issue, where do I go? They're running out of resources.
And, John, is that something that MLEC is looking at?
Chair Dembrough, Senator Rosenbaum, the short answer is yes.
Great. And we'll, you know, presumably have a chance to get into this, you know, quite deeply if the bill comes over here from the House. So thank you. Other questions about the system in general? Okay, well, I want to thank all three of you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. Share with us. And thank you for these charts. Please take them away.
Mementos.
My mind.
Yeah.
I've had that thought more than once.
Was there anyone else here who wanted to say anything about the workers' comp system in general? Ms. Earls, please come up.
For the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries, and I appreciate you giving me a couple of minutes of your time today. I wasn't invited, and I don't believe management was invited, to participate in the Workers' Compensation 101 that you just heard, so I haven't prepared any particular remarks. I would like to point out that management has been working with OTLA for the last several weeks on the bill that Mr. Elmer just talked to you about. We've had several conversations and tried to reach some consensus, and I don't think as of today we've been terribly successful, although I believe OTLA is going away and coming back to us with some further conversation. One thing I wanted to point out in response to Mr. Elmer's statistics is that the National Association of Insurance Commissioners took a look at House Bill 2764 and has come back to us with an estimate that it will raise system costs by 5% if it's implemented as is. So that's something that is of great concern to management, who, you know, pays a great deal of the premiums and employs the workers that we are hoping the system will compensate adequately for injuries. So we'd appreciate an opportunity to discuss this with you at a further point when we have an opportunity to be more prepared.
That's fine. Yes, we will be. You know, we have had workers' comp bills referred to us, and we'll get into them when we have public hearing.
Thank you,
Betsy. Okay, so with that, I'm going to close our informational hearing on workers' comp and going to open our work session on Senate Bill 454. And we have a number of amendments for this. Senate Bill 454 is the sick leave program bill. And we, on Monday, we heard the Dash 3 amendments, which were sort of the substantive amendments that came out of the work group, and which at the time we thought would be the one that we would be voting on, but that was seems like a long time ago. And you know, these amendments, they're fruitful and they multiply. So we now have at least 22 of them. And we are going to take motions on some of them. I'm going to open up the floor to the vice chair to move the first of them. Is that right?
Well, sure. Yeah, I would like to do that. I guess there... I was absent for part of the meeting last week, and I apologize for that because I had hearings in another room, and so I missed. I only caught the tail end of it, but I did catch some of it, and I did hear you talk about the fact that there was a work group, and there were people from, I guess you could say, the opponents, and then there were the proponents, and that we got together, and it wasn't a question of whether there would be a sick leave bill or not a sick leave bill. It was a question of what would the sick leave bill look like. And so I guess you could say that some people felt like it was being put into a room where, and I know this is not the intention here, but felt like you're being measured for what size funnel for which to have this put down your throat. So, the feeling amongst the small business community that I'm in contact with is that this mandatory sick leave bill, especially as written, less especially so with the Dash 3 amendments, but either way will hurt small business. It will hurt the bottom line of small business. It will increase prices for consumers. It will result in job losses. It will, as demonstrated as where it was tried in Seattle and in San Francisco, where they went down a similar path that resulted in reduced hours, staff cuts, reduced benefits to employees. And based on the Dash 5 amendments, the Legislative Revenue Office projects this bill will impose a cost of over $1.5 billion in new costs on Oregon businesses over the next 4 years. As a small business owner, it's difficult to understand why, when Oregon is such a small business-centric state, and that small businesses drive our economy, why small businesses seem to be under attack. And who are small businesses? They're the woman who starts the business in her basement because she's trying to pay the bills. And she gets up in the morning and she's getting her kids to school while talking on the phone to a customer and dropping the keys and making sure the baby's in the car seat while trying to get her kids to school and making sure that they down that cheese burrito on their way and so they get some breakfast. She's working all day. She's relying on friends and family to help her watch the kids, and she's hiring people to help her keep the promises that she's made to her customers. She's staying up late to pay the bills and do the payroll and putting her own paycheck in the drawer because there's not enough money to cover hers. And
so Vice Chair, so it sounds as if you want to move the Dash 2 amendments.
I'm sorry. Which, I just want to know.
Which I think address this.
I believe I would like to move several, and I will start with the Dash 6 amendments, which replace the bill by adding it to the Oregon Family Leave Act, which I'm not a big fan of adding things to the Oregon Family Leave Act, because I think that is another discussion to have, because there's a lot of conflict between the federal and the Oregon Family Leave Act, but it would still empower workers to take a sick leave without repercussions from their employer and without excessively burdening small businesses. And so I don't believe we can afford to lose small business, and I would prefer that option, so I would move the Dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 454.
Okay. So Vice Chair Thatcher has moved the Dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 454, and I'm not sure when those are dated, but whatever, the Dash 6 for the record. Okay, any discussion of this?
Well,
Senator
Knope. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I think putting them under the family leave law, I think, is less of a burden on those small businesses between 6 and 25 workers. And I just got handed a preliminary cost that Senator Thatcher has referred to, and it's pretty substantial. And I was going to wait till the Dash 4s to pass this out to the committee, but I mean, I do think it's relevant as it relates to the size of the amounts. And essentially, legislative revenue, as they looked at it, you know, their impact on new people taking advantage of this over the next 4 years is almost $1.6 billion to small business. And so
can I ask a question with that?
Just
to interrupt, sorry. Yes. Do you know what the methodology was that they used? Were they looking at the actual cost to Portland in the last year, or was this sort of hypothetical?
So this is reviewing this as a refundable tax credit. And so I think it would be great if LRO came in and told us about this, because I don't want to, you know, speak to kind of their work that was done. But essentially, this top part is the things that they plugged in terms of how they kind of assume this, like 36% of people are lacking paid sick leave right now. So, and that, I think you guys have argued that number might be higher. And so they went through and they tried to figure out, okay, what's the actual revenue impact? And so that's why I say, as we look at the Dash 6s, as well as some of the other dashes, I think we need to keep in mind that somebody's got to pay for this, and there is going to be a cost. And the question is how can you tailor a sick leave bill where it mitigates the impact on the smaller businesses between 6 and 25 employees, say, which the Dash 6s would do. So that's one of the reasons I would support the Dash 6s as opposed to the, you know, the overall bill.
Further discussion, and colleagues and members of the audience, just to kind of clarify, the chart that we have here is it's related to the Dash 4 amendments, which call for a tax credit where employers could claim a tax credit for expenses tied to delivering this benefit. So that's where it comes
right.
from.
Yep.
Anything else about just making this, making all of the requirements of OFLA tied to this? And let me just say, from my perspective, in terms of the process, we did look at the different elements of the bill and looked at where it made sense to connect with OFLA and where it didn't. And, you know, we did decide to connect the definition of family member, the more or less, the hours of increment, the just actually a number of elements related to OFLA. One that we did not was the employer size. And, you know, as you know, this, you know, what sort of came out of the compromise, as it were, around this bill was that it would relate to businesses with six or more employers, and that seemed to make the most sense. And I'll probably speak more to that as we get into further amendments. Yes, Senator Rosenthal.
Mr. Chair, I mean, I think luckily for this committee, we do have a model of a law that has been in effect now, if not for a very long time, for some time. And, you know, despite predictions by some that the sky would fall, the sky has not fallen under that law. And I think changing the threshold, as is suggested in this amendment, would leave out, I don't know the exact number, but a huge number of people. When people get sick, it doesn't really matter how many employees there are. If they're sick, they're sick, and that's what the bill is meant to get at. I think the current threshold is an appropriate one. It's one that's been working in places where a law has taken effect, and I can't support doing this.
All right, Senator.
Mr. Chair, can I just clarify?
Yes, please.
Senator Rosenbaum, are you referring to a specific entity or state that's passed it?
Portland, the Portland law is the one I'm talking about in Oregon. That is the same threshold that the current bill has, is the one that's in effect in Portland.
The six that you're referring
mm-hmm.
to?
Six or more.
Six or more.
Okay, any further discussion of the dash twos? No, dash sixes, sorry. Okay, seeing none, Carrie, could you call the roll on this, please?
Senator Gelser?
No.
Senator Kinnow?
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum?
No.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Demarest?
A nay. Okay, the motion fails.
Chair Dimbrough?
Yes. Senator Knope.
I move the dash four amendments to Senate Bill SB 454.
Okay. And actually, we should probably have Matt, could you tell us what the dash fours do?
Yes. Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee, the dash four amendments, provide employers a tax credit for a percentage of expenses related to paid sick leave according to a graduated scale based on employer size.
Okay. So you want to make the motion?
I did make a motion for the dash fours, but I would like to speak to them
yes,
a bit.
Yes, please do.
So, colleagues, I think, and I haven't had time to even digest this, but so Legislative Revenue Office went through and they looked at paid sick leave in two ways. One is a refundable credit and one is a non-refundable credit. And if you look at this as a refundable credit for the businesses that currently don't offer it, it's about $750 million in additional cost to small businesses over a biennium, and over the next 4 years, as they put on their chart, it's about almost $1.6 billion in additional cost. And so my concern is, and what I've heard from small businesses, is that they may not have a formal plan, but they do their best to allow employees to take off. And I have said I'm a supporter of paid sick leave. In fact, I wrote one for my employees about a dozen years ago, and it's worked really well. And I think I said the average was about four and a half days of use. But that's a decision that our board, because we're not a company per se, we're nonprofit, so we have a board. So I had to get that passed by my board for an employee benefit. And so we offer that now, and I think it's an attractive thing for workers. And I don't know if it's like the decision point, but I think it's a decision point of an employee who says, you know what, I mean, maybe I'm not going to make as much in salary, but I have these benefits, and these are great benefits for me because I have kids or I have a sick parent or whatever. And so It's worked, but I think that's a decision that's best between employees and the employer. And so when government's going to get involved and say, well, we're going to step in between that relationship between the employee and the employer, and we're going to mandate a certain amount. And this is the cost of that mandate, up to $1.5 billion. And this is preliminary. I mean, they've been working on this for a while, but we just got it back. And so the reason for the Dash 4s is if the state's going to step in and say, hey, this is a priority for us, we think you should have this, and we think you should do it this way, it seems only reasonable that we, as a state, ought to say, okay, we're willing to then pick up the cost for the mandate that we want to give you. Because just passing unfunded mandates onto business and not having to pay for them, I think is going to lead to significant job disruption, job losses, less hours, and ultimately probably less benefits for people. And that has happened in areas that have had leave, like Seattle and San Francisco have experienced some of these things. Has the business climate stopped? No. But I would suggest to you that Medford and Prineville and Bend and Ontario, or even Eugene or Salem, don't have the economic horsepower that a San Francisco or a Seattle does. And so I think the impact could potentially be greater. And so that's why I offer the Dash 4 amendments.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Yes,
I just want to add that small businesses are more sensitive to increases, any small increases in cost of doing business. And that's why, the reimbursements for those costs are higher for the smaller businesses. And that's why it was arranged that way, because the larger they are, the more ability they have to absorb those costs, and the smaller they are, the more sensitive to those costs increase. Right.
Thank you. And I'll say, I'm sensitive to that. And, as you'll recall, the bill that was sent to this committee covered all employers, right, irrespective of size. And, we did, and it was not an easy decision, but we did ultimately decide to exempt from payment, from paid sick leave, those very small employers, those with five or fewer employees. And, just to clarify, businesses with fewer than six, they still are expected to give sick leave if the worker needs it, but it would be without compensation. One of the interesting things that I've learned from this process is that we have a real discrepancy in this state, and I think in this country, between who has, in terms of who has access to paid leave. Of those who are, sort of middle class, or higher, and those who are earning $60,000 or more a year, more than 80% of those workers have access to sick leave. Whereas if you look at low-wage workers, barely a third do. That's sort of irrespective of the employer that they're working for. And that's what this bill is trying to rectify. It's trying to extend a benefit to low-wage workers. And you may say, well, low-wage workers should get the skills that will allow them to be higher-wage workers. And certainly that's part of the mission of this committee, is to improve our workforce development so that people are able to get the skills to move into more lucrative fields. But we still have, as a country, as a state, we have workers who are going to be doing those low-wage jobs. Somebody has to do them, and they get sick. Their kids get sick, and we need to be concerned about them. In terms of the tax credit notion, I guess one problem that I would have is that this would be a tax credit that would go to those companies that currently don't offer a benefit, And so we're essentially asking those who do offer a benefit to sort of pay for those who don't here. And that seems kind of counterproductive. Yes.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we assumed that you probably didn't want to give a tax credit to, you know, big companies like a Walmart or, you know, a Nike or somebody like that. And so that's why we tried to focus it to companies that don't currently offer that, because a lot of the bigger companies already do. And I think what we're talking about, I'm sure you could find a company that's larger that for whatever reason says we don't do this, but they probably have some other benefit. But I think the vast majority of companies that don't offer are ones that don't think they can afford it, and they're probably below 25 or 50 workers in terms of their size. And so, and I think you're right, they typically are lower wage workers. And I think if we remember back to our presentation from the, I think it was the Employment Department presented, and I think about half of those minimum wage workers, there's obviously, you know, you can try to figure out what's lower wage. I mean, probably some would say under $15 an hour, right, are lower wage workers. But let's just take minimum wage. Half of those were workers were essentially kids between the ages of 16 and 24 who are working, for the most part, part-time. And so my understanding—
Actually, I don't remember that being the case, but yeah.
I think it is, but we could check on that. But so I think a significant part of the workers that we're going to talk about covering are going to be exactly those workers. Not that kids don't get sick, because they do, but it's not like we're the majority of these people that we're going to be offering paid sick leave to are necessarily full-time workers who are trying to essentially are the breadwinner. I think a lot of those aren't breadwinners. And so if this didn't apply to part-time workers, I think there would be a better argument there. But and offering that to a full-time worker, as Senator Rosenbaum said, you know, hey, you know, the kids get sick and, you know, you need paid leave, and otherwise it creates budget problems. And I do agree with that. And I mean, that's why, you know, I instituted a policy at our company. But I think we need to be really careful and about projecting unfunded mandates onto to small businesses who are, I mean, they're struggling right now. And I've even been told by some of the businesses in my district, I don't think we're going to make it, especially if we have minimum wage on top of this and some of the other regulations that are coming. You know, it's all cumulative, and it's kind of death by a thousand cuts. But in this particular case, I mean, it's death by $1.6 billion in an unfunded mandate. And that's why I put forward the tax credit idea. I think just for us to make a policy decision that says, does the state, if it's so important to the state to have this policy and to mandate it on small business, you know, let's look at how we might be able to help these small businesses institute the policy without having to cut workers.
Thank you. Any further discussion of this? Okay, seeing none, Carrie, could you call the roll on this, the dash boards?
Senator Gelser?
No.
Senator Snow?
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum?
No.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
Yes.
Chair Dembo?
No. Okay. That motion fails. Next up.
Mr. Chair, thank you for your patience. Yes. I move to adopt the dash 2 amendments dated March 23rd to Senate Bill 454.
Okay. So Vice Chair Thatcher has moved the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 454. And they're dated March 23rd, 2015. Matt, you want to tell us what they do?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 2s exempt employers with less than 50 employees from providing paid sick leave and requires employers with less than 50 employees to provide protective unpaid sick leave.
So, Senator Thatcher?
Yeah. Well, I think I saw a number the other day. It said about 92% of businesses in Oregon are 25 or fewer, and I don't know what it is for 50 or fewer, but if it was okay, if it was good enough for President Obama to exempt 50 and under for the Affordable Care Act, it should be good enough for Oregon to exempt under that same number for the Mandatory Sick Leave Pay Act.
Well, it's an interesting analogy. you know, of course, the 50 applies to the employer mandate in the Affordable Care Act, and workers who are working for smaller firms do have other options under the Affordable Care Act. They can go on the exchange and get subsidies for their care, whereas the workers here would not. They would just go without a day's pay.
But so do the small business owners. They would not have to add, but there you go.
Any further discussion of the dash twos? Okay, seeing none, Carrie, would you call the roll, please?
No.
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum?
No.
Vice Chair
Thatcher?
Yes.
No. Okay, this motion fails. Senator Knope, is it your turn?
It's my turn. It's ping pong.
Thank you.
Chair Denver, I move the dash 7 amendments to Senate Bill 454.
Senator Knope has moved the dash 7 amendments to Senate Bill 454, and those are also dated March 23rd, 2015. And Matt, would you explain it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the dash 7 amendments limit paid sick leave benefit to only full-time employees.
Senator Knope?
Thank you, Chair Denbro. I think we talked about this briefly, and I won't belabor it too much. But again, I mean, I think in terms of trying to focus this so it isn't financially destructive to small business owners, applying this to full-time employees, or at least starting there, you know, we meet every 8 months or so, roughly, on average. So we could obviously adjust this later if we needed to, but I think starting with full-time employees is a good place to start on this, and I think it solves a lot of potential problems that we're going to get into in the dash 8s and the dash 9s, as well as other issues around part-time employees. And I think, I believe under this bill, for instance, I think like football coaches who are paid and maybe their hours aren't tracked now, I think they would qualify for paid sick leave because they're part-time workers in some cases. Sometimes they're attached to the school. I think there's potential for substitute teachers as well, I think, which doesn't really make any sense because they call you and ask you if you want to come in. But I think there's going to be a lot of potential unintended consequences, including for my own Parks and Rec district, who indicated the original bill would cost them $77,000 a year because it does apply to part-time and seasonal workers. And the way you've structured it probably has shrunk that cost some, but I think it's probably still in the $50,000 to $60,000 range would be my guess. I haven't heard back from them on which amendments yet and the cost. But so it's going to have a significant cost across the spectrum. And if just one park district is talking about that kind of cost, imagine all the other government entities that taxpayers put money into, and you know, where do they get that money? And do they get that money from the you know, the services that they currently provide, or do they go out and ask for tax increases or a bigger tax base to do that? And so, I think we need to be concerned about the ripple effect, and that's why I think the dash sevens are a reasonable thing to start out with if you're going to start out with a paid sick leave bill.
Thank you.
That was me being short, by the way.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
I will say, although you didn't bring this up, we did hear it during the public testimony that part-time workers don't need this benefit because they're just working part-time. It's easier for them to adjust their schedules if they're ill or if their kids are ill. And, you know, that may have once been true, but in my experience, it's not true anymore. We have so many people who are working multiple part-time jobs, and, you know, in some cases, their schedules are more constrained even than full-time employees. And so, you know, I would say that all of these workers are already, their hours are being tracked for the, you know, wage and hour purposes. They have to, the employer has to do quarterly reports on them. So it's not as if this is adding a burden of record keeping. And, you know, as you know, the amended bill has seriously reduced the record-keeping requirement. So we're trying to get it aligned with the reports that they already have to do on a quarterly basis. You know, I think the other thing is, you know, because we've made accrual based on, you know, on the number of hours that they work, these part-time workers are going to be earning leave much more slowly than full-time workers. And that, together with the requirement that they can't begin to use their leave until they've worked for 90 days, is, you know, is really going to reduce, you know, I think the, you know, the burden on employers who are concerned about people coming and going and this creating a burden. So that would be my response.
I think there will be some paperwork still. I mean, regardless of, there's quarterly reporting for tax purposes and that, but this is going to be a different set of tracking that will be required, especially if people do come and go, and with the, if you come back within 180 days and then you still get to keep whatever you had before, there's still going to be that management that will be required.
Right, but the employer has to keep records on their payroll, you know, for tax purposes. And, you know, I think it's not as if they suddenly have to start paying attention to these workers, you know, and recording their hours. They're recording them anyway for payroll purposes, it seems to me. So it may be in a slightly different form, but, you know, I think that once that adjustment is made, then, you know, it becomes just part of their ongoing work processes.
Right. The adjustments would have to be made. I don't know if payroll programs are necessarily already set up for managing this. It would have to be programmed in, and that is an expense. And, yeah. You know, that's...
Right. We're doing our best to minimize those.
Mr. Chair, yeah. So can I ask you a question about mm-hmm. that? So under the original bill, for instance, we'll just take my policy. So we accrue at one day a month up to 10 days. And so under the original bill, we would have had to report or record under a one set of standards. But because we are, I think, basically about twice, I was trying to do the math in my head, but it's dangerous. About twice the accrual rate as what the bill stands for, so we wouldn't have to do any extra reporting or record keeping, correct?
Yes, that is correct. I mean, it sounds like you're meeting, you know, that plan meets the standard. The one thing you would need to do is you would need to let the employees know how much leave they have, and, you know, if I mean, I think a lot of employers, if not most employers, include that with each pay stub. If you're doing that, then you don't have to do anything. But if you don't do that, then you would want to communicate that to the worker on a quarterly basis.
We do, and that's exactly what we do, assuming that everybody turns their timesheets in on time and the bookkeeper gets them and is able to put them on that payroll. Otherwise, they make it up, you know, vacation time and that type of thing. Later on, but yeah, that's exactly how it happens. And so I think you're right, it is reduced from where it was in the original bill, but I think there's still going to be some expense to small business. I don't think we should minimize that, but it's definitely down from where it was, which I think they'll appreciate.
Great. Any further discussion of where are we? The dash?
Dash seven.
Sevens.
Dash seven.
You were going to vote with me on this one.
No? That's right. Gee, I've lost my script. Thank you. Carrie, could you call the roll, please?
Senator Gelser?
No.
Senator Knope?
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum?
No.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
Aye.
No.
Dang.
So close.
All right. The motion fails.
I thought I had him.
I thought we had him there for a second.
Vice Chair Thatcher.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move the dash 8 amendments dated 3/23 to Senate Bill 454.
Okay, Vice Chair Thatcher has moved the dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 454. Those are dated March 23rd, 2015. And Matt, what does this amendment do?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the dash 8 amendments exempt agricultural workers.
That's it. agricultural workers, I mean, as you can see, non-farm payroll, I mean, agriculture is a different industry. It's a different sort of business. It is treated differently all throughout Oregon law. And the testimony that we received on that one really long day that we had and that we received, I just remember hearing time after time that that there may be some ability to raise prices a little bit locally, but their ability to compete internationally and with other states will be severely curtailed, and they would be extra sensitive to this price increase because they have very, very small margins to deal with. And this will be extra burdensome on them. Even though it amounts to like a 3% payroll tax, it's a huge burden for them. And that's why I suggest we exempt agricultural businesses and maybe have further discussions on how maybe we should deal with the those who work for agricultural businesses to make it right for both the workers and the businesses.
So let me say, just, you know, in the small group or one-on-one meetings we had with employer groups, we did hear sort of something that we heard multiple times was, we would like to be exempted from this. But if you're not going to exempt us, don't exempt anyone else. And it becomes, you know, to start cherry picking industries like that becomes problematic, I think. You know, the fact is that agricultural workers get sick like all workers do, and in fact, you know, they're doing really hard work, so they may be they may be getting, you know, they've got to be really tough, but they do get sick as the rest of us do. And we have, you know, we have included a requirement in here which, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your perspective, is actually going to exempt a lot of agricultural seasonal workers from ever using this benefit, because there's a 90-day requirement. You can't start using the benefit until you've worked for 90 days. And so for, you know, truly seasonal workers, there will be many who will have accrued leave and they won't be able to use it. And, you know, that I think that will probably reduce the burden on business. We've learned that, you know, many, actually, probably the great majority of seasonal workers are actually employed by labor contractors, who, you know, who are responsible for the record keeping and for, you know, providing the sick leave to the worker. So again, I think that does reduce the burden on the worker. Many workers, agricultural workers, are actually working on a piece rate basis. And if they have to take a sick day, they're probably just going to be paid the minimum wage for that day. So they don't really have an incentive, you know, to get sick or to, you know, to, obviously if they're really sick, they will. But, you know, we did hear some concern that laborers will abuse this benefit, but I think that's really not likely.
Well, that was not my contention that there would be abuse. It was just my contention that there was grave concern from the farmers out there that this was going to really impact them negatively, and they were very concerned. So I just wanted there to be some further discussion before we jumped headlong into this.
I did also hear that this would put us at a disadvantage with California, but I believe that California's new sick leave law includes agricultural workers.
And I might add, it's only for 24 hours accumulated.
Great. Further discussion of the dash 8? Okay, seeing none, Carrie, could you call the roll, please?
Senator Yeltsin?
No.
Senator Knope?
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum?
No.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
Yes.
And Chair Dembrough?
No. Okay. The dash 8s have failed. Dash 9s, anyone? No?
Yes, Chair Dembrough. I move the dash 9 amendment to Senate Bill 454.
Okay. Senator Knope has moved the dash 9 amendments to Senate Bill 454. Those two are March 23rd, 2015. And what do these do?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the dash 9 amendments exempt seasonal workers.
Okay. We've kind of talked about that. Is it?
It's a little different, actually.
Chair Dembrough, I think, you know, in terms of seasonal workers, places like Central Oregon, the coast, where we have significant recreation, tourism, rely heavily on seasonal workers, and I think increasing costs for seasonal workers means there's just going to be fewer jobs, and because there's not a lot of profit in the industry right now, and so I think it's going to be hard for many of those companies to figure out how they're going to staff, and they'll probably staff at a lower rate. And you know, I just think generally that it hurts job creation when we add significant costs, which this, I think, very well could, based on the revenue estimate of if you had a credit. So that's why I proposed the dash 9 amendments.
Okay. Further discussion of this? Again, I think workers who are truly seasonal probably are not going to meet that 90-day threshold. They may, but likely they won't. Certainly, those who are brought on, you know, for the holidays, you know, would not. Conceivably, someone who's there for the entire summer perhaps could at the very end. Any further discussion of this one? Okay, Carrie, please.
Senator Yeltsin?
No.
Senator Knope?
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum?
No.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Dembrough?
No. Okay, the dash 9s have failed.
Well, I don't have any more amendments to move, but I would like to discuss a few of the other amendment ideas that we had, just to kind of expedite things a little bit. And I appreciate your patience, Mr. Chair, I do. You've been sterling as far as listening to all this. And because I know that, Anyhow, the dash 5 amendments would, we kind of touched on that earlier, that would give, talks about the giving a tax credit, and we talked about that a little bit earlier. The dash 10 amendments would reduce the separation gap from 180 days to 90 days, which would bring it more in line with the 90-day use. It would just kind of make bookkeeping a little easier and also not have burden an employer with carrying it for so long. It would make bookkeeping and record keeping a little easier. The dash 11 amendments would change the accrual rate from 1 in 30 hours to 1 in 40 hours, because 40 hours has traditionally been recognized as a work week, and it is traditionally a unit. You know, 40 hours is traditionally a unit of work. The Dash 12 amendment would give businesses some time to implement. Specifically in this amendment, it would give them 5 years to implement the mandatory paid sick leave. In the Dash 13 amendments, it would change the amount of sick leave that can be accrued or rolled over to a maximum of 24 hours instead of 40 hours, bringing it more in line with what our neighbors to the south do in California.
Okay. Do we have any other amendments that we can move at this time? Senator Rosenbaum?
Pardon? Oh, I'm sorry.
It's putting words in France, just kidding.
I was drifting off here. Yes, I do have a motion. Chair Dembrough, I move to adopt the Dash 22 amendments to Senate Bill 454 dated March 25th of 2015.
Okay. Senator Rosenbaum has moved the Dash 22 amendments to Senate Bill 454. Those are dated March 25th, 2015. And colleagues, you have those before you on the dais. They're really hot off the presses. After we heard the Dash 3s on Monday, there were a number of technical issues that arose, things that, where things could have been clearer the wording wasn't quite right. And just as an example of that, you'll remember that we added a provision to the bill that allows employers who have policies that allow workers to donate time to other workers. The way that it was written suggested that was a required part of the benefit, and that was not the intent. The intent was that we didn't want the bill to preclude employers from having such a program as part of their policy. And there were those kinds of things. What took us to the Dash 22s was we wanted to really make clear some of the provisions related to enforcement, and to make it clear that penalties could be pursued for violations of the program, but damages only in the case of discrimination or retaliation. And so the bill makes that clearer. And the final thing that caused us to get to 22, we almost were there at 16, but we moved into the 20s because it wasn't really clear that during that one-year grace period that we've put into the bill, where BOLI will not be assessing penalties. They just to make it clearer that they will not be assessing penalties during that year as everybody's getting used to this system. However, if there is a proven case of discrimination or retaliation, they can take action during that year. So that essentially is what we have before us in the 22s. And I'd be happy to answer any other questions about them. Okay, seeing none, any further discussion of the Dash 22s? Great. Okay, Carrie, would you please call the roll?
Senator Gelser?
Yes.
Senator Knope?
Yes.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Yes. Yes.
Yes. So the Dash 22s have been adopted. Senator Rosenbaum, I think we're ready for the base bill.
Yes. Chair Dembrough, I move Senate Bill 454 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, Senator Rosenbaum has moved Senate Bill 454 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion?
Yes.
Me too.
Me too.
Be patient.
You can go in order. I don't have to go up.
No. Vice Chair?
Oh, just think of that small business owner. Just think of that person down at the big town hero. Gets up early every day, the baker down the street, and the gas station owner. They don't get their sick time. They're filling in for the employees. They're burning the midnight oil, making the bills, making the payroll, putting the paycheck in the drawer, sometimes waiting several weeks before they get paid. Think of them and think about some of the burdens that we're adding this session. And think about how some of these businesses who are barely keeping their heads above water and how we're basically putting weights on them and telling them to swim harder, and some of them aren't going to make it, and it's a shame.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Gelsinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I wanted to thank everybody that worked so hard to amend the bill. I always think it's a little bit of a good sign when advocates for and against the bill are all a little bit dissatisfied. I think in the end it's a good bill. I'm thinking about some of the people that I met talking to over the course of the past year, and one woman in particular sticks out to me. She lived in Albany and got quite ill. She stayed home from work. She had a really high fever. Her employer wrote her up for not coming to work. She had a doctor's note, was still written up, so she went back to work. She continued working. She ended up collapsing while she worked, ended up hospitalized, and she still ended up losing her job. That's who I'm thinking about when we work on these bills. I think the other piece of testimony that really grabbed me when we had that long hearing that night were from the students, and I had never thought about this element of not having access to paid sick leave before, where there's a parent that has multiple children at home and an older student, a middle school student or a high school student, needs to take the day off of school in order to be home to care for the younger siblings, and the way that that contributes to success in school and that student's ability then to complete school and be able to earn a wage that will help them to support their families. I think this is a bill that, with the amendments, really strikes a balance between the interests of those very vulnerable workers and makes it workable for the businesses. I think our state will be stronger and our workplaces healthier, and I'm really happy that we are able to move this forward this session.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Pinot?
Just a couple questions and a comment. The fiscal, it doesn't really have anything on it, or what did it say?
Yeah, Matt, could you tell us
Mr.
about
Chair
that?
And Senator Canope, the fiscal that was issued was a fiscal light due to the recommendation for a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means.
What is fiscal? Is that like a light beer? What is it? I understand what that is.
Mr. Chair, Senator Canope, that means that the fiscal analysis will be performed in full once the bill reaches the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Oh, okay. Mr. Chair, do we expect any policy amendments in the Joint Ways and Means Committee?
We're trying to avoid those, and that's why we've got to number 22 today.
I noticed that legislative revenue is here, and maybe I didn't do a great job in terms of their work. Is it possible that we could have him come up and just briefly go through, since we had a question about how this was put together? I don't think it'll take much time.
I have no objection to that. Chris, could you come forth? And welcome, and thank you for your work.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I haven't been following the committee. I've been down in hearing
room A. Oh, yeah. Please give your name.
Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. I haven't been following the committee. I've been down in the Revenue Committee. So I'm not – there was – I believe I provided some information on certain amendments to the bill, and I assume that's the
correct
work that is in question.
Yeah. We had some questions about the methodology that was used for coming up with those tax credit estimates.
The the question was around around a credit related to the cost of the paid leave, the paid sick leave. And the original question was around a refundable tax credit that would be granted to the employers for the cost of the paid sick leave that granted. So speaking to the methodology in trying to construct a framework or think around how that credit, what it would cost and how it would play out, the approach I took was looking at the private sector non-farm employment number for the state, and there's a forecast for that from the state economist's office, and then using some information from the trying to get down to the number of employees that might who don't have sick leave now. So there was an adjustment for employers who had fewer than six employees, and then I found some information that indicated, in very broad terms, the percent of employees who do not have access to sick leave. So basically, I took the non-farm employment, which was about 1.5 million people, and they came up with an estimate of around 500,000 employees who do not currently have access to paid sick leave. So that's the number of employees we're talking about. That's that population. And then I found some information on the average number of sick leave days taken by people who have access to sick leave. And the information that I found was that on average, now this is averaging across all employees, on it for a year, workers take four paid sick leave days a year for themselves and then one for a family member. And again, these are averages over all employees. So again, just sticking with numbers that I could cite, then I get to, so I have number of employees and the number of sick days, and then the question is wages. So also from the forecast, I have average wages for all employees. And I basically take that information and get to a total sick days taken annually, which is basically the 500,000 workers times the 5 days per year. And then the cost of that would be the wages for that day. So I took average annual wage, divided that by the number of workdays in a year, and got down to around $200 for a workday. And so multiplying the $200 times the 500,000 people or employees without paid sick leave gets to a cost, if you will, of about $360 million, at least in 2016. And so if the policy is a refundable credit, then that credit just equals the $361 million, because it doesn't matter what the tax liability of the taxpayer is. That would just go back. It would reduce their tax liability down to zero, and then the additional amount of the tax credit would be just issued in a refund. A variation on that policy was a percent of this cost, depending on the size of the employer. The smaller the employer, the larger the credit. So I think up to employees of 25, it was 100% credit. And then for 25 to 50 employees in a firm, it was a 75% credit, and so forth on the way down. And then that estimate was about $220 million. And then in reading the bill, there was a question of to whom the tax credit would apply. I mean, the initial request I got wasn't really tied to language in an amendment. It was just kind of a conceptual. There has since have been some amendments drafted. And taking a look at those, it wasn't clear if it would apply to just the employees who would now have sick leave due to the bill, or if it would just apply to all employees in the state. I didn't see anything that specifically limited it to those that would be affected by the bill, and there are some policy complications with that. Again, in trying to put some numbers around this, I also took that same methodology and applied it to all employees, because presumably if it did apply to everybody, then it's basically every employee now who gets paid sick leave, if there were a credit granted to those employers. And that's where the numbers were about $1.4 billion for a refundable credit and $660 million for the phased-out piece. So I don't know if I struck the right amount of detail in terms of a method, but that's kind of the framework that I was starting with. And then there was a different variation for a non-refundable tax credit. So I can stop there, or I can go into more detail if if you would like.
I think that's good enough for now, unless anyone has any further questions of Chris. Appreciate your work with this. You know, of course, we could all quibble with some of the assumptions, but thank you for your help with it. Okay. Senator Knope, did you want to say anything in conclusion?
You know, I've been a small business owner. I started out when I was 20 years old. As a small business owner, and you know, I can tell you that this is a type of policy that would have been very difficult because my wife and I started out when we were like 19 and 20 years old, cleaning business, and it grew, and we hired part-time employees, and I think this is the type of a benefit that you would like to be able to offer, but at the same time, I think it would have caused us to do one of two things: either raise prices or trim back our workforce. And it's not that we wouldn't have wanted to offer it, we just wouldn't have known how to provide the benefit without essentially reducing our living, which was, you know, was okay, but by no means were we were we rich business owners. Now I'm I have some employees and that I manage, and you know, that's not my money, it's our association and our members' money, but through their board have determined that this is a policy that they wanted to have, and I think that's the right place, is for people to be able to determine, do I have enough money, can I do this benefit, or am I offering other benefits to my employees? And so I'm always concerned when government mandates something that I think has an effect. And you know, when I was a small business owner, I recall times when an employee was out sick or whatever, and we paid them, but we didn't have an official policy, and we just did the best we could, and it didn't happen very often. And my concern would be if you have this policy, that there are opportunities to abuse it, and I've had people abuse it, our policy, and we've had to terminate those employees, but not necessarily just for that, because if you're essentially not telling the truth about where you've been, or you know that you're sick, that's not just a sick leave problem. That's a that's a significant problem for the business. But under this bill, the concern would be that we would have to do a lot more due diligence, probably hire an attorney, make sure we do everything right. It's going to increase the costs of letting that employee go, because you know that potentially in the offing is a lawsuit for not allowing them to use their sick time, and you know that you'd have to have a significant amount of proof in order to do that, and to make sure you've made the case that there's abuse going on. And I always tell my staff, I don't want to be put in the position of being a cop. I'd be a lousy cop. So I just want everything to be as transparent as it can be. And you know, right now we've got a great group of employees, you know, no problems, but you know, from sometimes that changes. And you think about multiplying that across literally hundreds of thousands of employees across the state. And I think the policy, I think, creates a significant issue with both cost and employment. And the economy is a lot more fragile in eastern, central, and southern Oregon than it is in the metro area. And a one-size-kind-of-fits-all policy doesn't work well. It doesn't work well with land use. Doesn't work well, doesn't work well with a lot of things as it relates to smaller areas. And it's not that that employees don't get sick in eastern and southern and central Oregon, because they do. And I would love for all businesses to offer the policy, but we're not encouraging it. We're mandating it, and we're not paying for it. And so that's why it would be a no on this particular bill at this time.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Rosenbaum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I first want to commend the process that brought us to where we are. I think a lot of people worked very hard on this version, and I think, you know, we had a great process of hearings where I think we heard from every single person who showed up to testify, and I want to thank my colleagues for hanging in there that night in particular until we had heard from everybody. We heard a lot. I think the amendment before us now attempts to take the input that we got and to the greatest extent possible try to modify the bill and provide for some of the circumstances that people talked about. I also want to thank Charlie Cheek, because I can see from just what we looked at today the amount of work that went into not only the amendment we're about to vote on, but all the others that he drafted too, and that is to be commended. I think that this is it's something that the time has come to do. I think when you think about people that will be affected by this particular bill, we have a group of people who are largely working for not that much money in very hard jobs, and often they're in contact with vulnerable people. They're in contact with all of us if they're serving our food, preparing our food. You don't want people in those circumstances to be coming to work sick. In fact, you really don't want anybody coming to work when they're sick and exposing their coworkers to getting sick too. And that's not good for them, and it's not good for anybody. It's certainly not good for the children of people who need their parents to be able to get them when they're sick and take care of them. I've heard, as Senator Gelser said, far too many stories about what that's like and the impact on people's lives. So I feel good about being able to vote on this version of the bill. And finally, I just want to commend you, Mr. Chair, for all the work that you have personally put into this and being open to hearing from all sides. I think we have a good bill, and I'm proud to be voting yes on it.
Thank you very much, Senator. Just to conclude the comments on this bill, I would agree with you, Senator, that this is a bill really whose time has come. Most countries, you know, if you look at our neighboring countries and countries around the world, the notion of paid sick leave is just, it's the norm. Now, obviously, it had to start at some point. But now it's something that nobody questions, and it's the norm, and so the playing field is level among all businesses, and it, in the end, as we've seen in the in Portland, for example, the dire predictions of the effect of passing that ordinance just have not really come true. I just remind you of all the people who came forth and testified on the bill. We didn't hear from any Portland businesses that came in and complained that the bill was hurting their bottom line. And, they did certainly have concerns about the fact that the ordinance was just limited to Portland, and they were having problems when their operations extended beyond Portland. And they had some problems with the implementation of the Portland ordinance. And their, the number one concern, the two top concerns that we heard from business organizations was get a preemption on this thing, have a consistent statewide standard, and do it in a way that is going to be as easy to implement as possible. And that's what we've struggled to do, and I think largely successfully. Again, like any new program, there will be some wrinkles, at the beginning, but they will work themselves out. And I think everyone will be proud that we live in a state that treats workers and families in this way. I want to just join Senator Rosenbaum also in, again, extending thanks to Charlie Cheek. I thanked him on Monday for the Dash 3s. Now I need to thank him seven times over, you know, for the 22s. Really great work by Charlie. But also the original chief sponsors of this bill, Senator Steiner Hayward, Representative Vega Peterson, who worked for many, many hours over the last 2 years in work group and meeting with people, and also all the members of that work group, some of whom are here in this room, and you know, for all your hard work and all the work that, all the input that we got, and not only the input but the tenor of the meetings that we had, which I thought, you know, were very, very productive and led to many changes in the original bill that I think make it better. And thank you all for our discussion of this bill, both, you know, during the public hearings and in the work sessions. And so I think it's time to move forward. And so, Carrie, would you please call the roll?
Senator Yeltsin?
Aye.
Senator Knapp?
No.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
No.
Aye. Okay, the motion passes, and Senate Bill 454 will go to Ways and Means.
And Mr. Chair, I'll like to serve notice of a possible minority report, just throwing it out there.
Yeah. Can you do that if it's going to Ways and Means?
Because things can change. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, for some reason, the Ways and Means referral was lifted.
Yes.
Then we could do a minority report. If it, once it goes to Ways and Means, it immediately sheds the minority report.
So, and this, we is may not want to do a minority report. It's just reserving that right. Okay.
Right. Thank you for exercising your caution.
Yeah, just doing it. All right. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. All right, colleagues. We are adjourned. See you Monday.
Thank you.